And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We're here every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Of course, shows are all available on podcast. Don't forget to visit our after the show. You have to be riveted to the whole show every second, so you can't do that unless you're multitasking. Don't forget to visit our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page for Occupied Territory. Just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook. And today we have a guest, Chuck Collins, who has a new book out, 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. So that's hopeful. Hi, Chuck.
Good to be with you.
Let me introduce you to people so they know who they're listening to. Chuck Collins is an organizer and senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, directing its program on inequality and the common good, as well as a co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and Inequality.org. He is the author of several books, including Wealth and Our Commonwealth with Bill Gates Sr. and Economic Apartheid in America with Felice Yeskel. Actually, sometimes we've had Sam Pizzicati on here a couple of times. Do you know him from IPS?
Oh, yeah. No, he's my close colleague.
Yeah. He was on once, and then I frequently quote from him with his updates too much. So the book, basically, it's a small book. It's from Barrett Kohler Publishers, and it's pretty direct, and it's pretty – I would suggest that it's it lays out everything people really need to know about what the inequality is, how it got that way, the nuts and bolts of it. And then basically what we can do about it. So maybe we can go through it, you know, in a linear way. You could lay out what the book is, what it does.
Great. Well, I mean, basically I'm looking at how did we get here, you know, so how did these inequalities emerge? And the simple phrase I would characterize it as that the rules of the economy have been changed to funnel wealth to the 1%. At the expense of the 99%. And when I mean rules like tax policy and global trade rules and government policies and regulation of corporations and minimum wage laws. That things are sort of tilted toward asset owners at the expense of wage earners.
Now, these are bills enacted into laws by Congress, signed by presidents. Also, we're talking about executive orders and the way agencies conduct their business, right? All of this. And the Supreme Court.
Yes, and sort of sometimes the practices of private global corporations as well sort of contribute to the whole dynamic.
Mm-hmm. So people are pretty well aware now about the income inequality, and this show is devoted to the Occupy movement and its issues. But you really do go into some detail. And now it's impossible to ever do these kinds of things without making comparisons to, A, the Gilded Age, and, B, the era right before the collapse in 1929, right?
That's right. I mean, that was really the last time we had such extreme levels of inequality. And I think it's important for people to realize, hey, we did reverse a period of extreme inequality 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it by public policies that raised the floor and created opportunity for low- and middle-income people to have a good life. But we also did it by passing laws such as the estate tax and the income tax that focused on breaking up concentrated wealth and power at the very, very top. And so 30s, 40s, and 1950s, we did things to ensure that we became a more equal society.
Now, what is it that enabled people, what was it about, without going into like 10 textbooks worth of information, but why is it that this country was motivated to do it, and how is it they were able to do that then and don't seem to be able to do it now without some kind of almost revolution breaking out?
Well, I think part of it was there was 30 years of organizing work, the rural, you know, starting really in 1890s, you know, the rural populists and mm-hmm. the urban labor movement and others. And I think that it just was an awakening. People were, A, they felt like they were being, their standard of living was under attack, that their wealth was being, you know, vacuum cleaned up to the big trusts and the 1%. They saw how corrupt the political system had become, that it was captured and dominated by the big corporations and the rich. And they used every means possible, protesting and the media such as it was at the time, mostly print and street corner speeches and the like, to make the case that too much inequality was bad for everybody. And so that, and I think now, I think we're in a parallel awakening. I think that's the good news. The Occupy movement and the We Are the 99% movement is the really the beginning of, you know, huge awakening around how these inequalities are undercutting the quality of life in so many ways.
There were when you talk about the populist movement, and then of course then we're talking about the formation of unions right around 1900, give or take 10, 20 years in either direction, right? And that was formed through a lot of blood, toil, jail time, and everything else, right? I mean, serious, much worse than has happened to anybody in the Occupy movement so far, right?
And that's right. I mean, yeah, we're talking about a Red Scare, you know, crushing and immigrant organizing efforts, deporting leaders, jailing Eugene Debs. So, right. Yeah, there was a level of repression.
Well, then they put him in jail for, what was it, 20 years? They sentenced him to 20 years, I think. So, I mean, this is serious stuff. And also back in those days, there were incidents where there was attempts to reclaim, you know, more banks to come and get farms where the farmers would just, you know, stand out on the road with rifles. You had people in West Virginia, which had, I think this is in the 20s. Chris Hedges writes about this in a book that's going to come out soon, about the largest armed uprising in this country after the Civil War, which happened in West Virginia when people had enough of this. I guess what I'm dancing around here is there's a lot of people these days who are so fed up. And let me just cite two examples, which you just pick up the newspaper any day. It was no more than a week ago that the Consumer Protection Agency that was set up by the president didn't enforce any new rules, or they even weakened rules on credit card companies sending out new credit card solicitations, A. B, we noticed just the other day, which was front page news in a lot of places, that federal regulators are not going after banks the way they should be going after. In other words, the government has seemed to completely stopped representing the people. And there are people now who, and I'm talking about people who are level-headed. You know, I've talked to people, you know, authors, you know, politicians, everybody. People who used to be level-headed and angry are now past the point of that, and they're almost disgusted and sick of the entire system, almost suggesting, although you can't do this because it's against the law and nobody's going to say this in the corporate media, that we've had enough of actually the way the government is working, and maybe there's other ways to take it back. You know, I mean, this is what happens if you keep pushing people down long enough. Sorry to make a speech here, but it's going to spring up in a pretty nasty way, right?
I'm with you. I mean, you know, if you go on the website of We Are the 99%, you read people's stories, whether it's people feeling trapped in poverty or seeing their middle-class dreams just kind of implode, or young people who have so much, you know, played by the rules and got all this debt and then they see no way out of it, that we realize the pressure is just going to keep building. And the current political system, which is completely captured by the 1%, captured by a couple thousand global corporations, is completely incapable of responding and addressing those grievances. And so basically the pressure is going to keep building, the political system is going to be unresponsive, and that's why it's important that people don't just sort of wait around for politicians to shift. The good news is, you know, you see even like the Democrats running out front of public opinion. They're not leading, they're just trying to mirror the changing political opinion, which is, hey, the wealthy should pay more taxes, we should pass the Buffett rule, we should regulate corporations. Even as Wall Street is lobbying to weaken regulation on the banks, the general public understands that's a dead end. That's where I think you're going to see much more militant direct action. Monday, Tuesday is the Wells Fargo shareholder meeting in San Francisco, but all around the country, people will be occupying Wells Fargo bank branches and basically saying, you know, this bank is a reckless actor. It should be broken apart. It should be dismantled as it is.
Well, all of the big banks for that matter.
Yeah, right. The six big banks that are responsible for trashing the economy, their share of the market has grown since the economic meltdown, thanks to us, the taxpayers, right? So we have to take direct action. We have to have conversations like you and I are having, educational events and teach-ins, but then I think we have to basically go and occupy space. And until the pressure builds that the grip of big money the grip of corporations on our political system cracks, and who knows how that will happen.
Well,
it will shift.
Crack is an interesting word. I mean, a crack, a break, a split. I mean, sometimes you could. What we're talking about here, so let's not bandy words, I guess. What we're talking about here is, and this is something that happened in the 60s, and it happened in the 30s, and it always seems to happen all the time, is that people are going to have to break laws. And I'm not talking about violence, of course, but
yeah.
I'm talking about mass disobedience that happened with the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. If people didn't actually break laws en masse, then things don't change. I mean, Frederick Douglass's famous quote, right? Power concedes nothing without a demand. There's more to that quote. I mean, he said either morally or physically, you know. So, I mean, the idea, also, you mentioned that the Democratic Party seems to sort of try to reflect or mirror what the public opinion is, but people have no respect or no belief. It's total cynicism now, because as the president and his his acolytes are making speeches all over the place, especially the president, about this is unacceptable. We have to have the Buffett rule. A few folks have all the money. You know, I'm sick of this word folks, by the way. But
folks, right?
Yeah, if I never hear that word again, you know. But because I keep thinking of Volkswagen, Volksdeutsch, you know. But he keeps saying all these things. Yet at the same time, the minute he's saying it on a stage in Ohio to some unemployed workers or something like that, or people who are making so little money, somebody, one of his secretaries or somebody in charge of one of his agencies, is stealing more from us. So how do people believe a damn word that any of them are saying anymore?
Well, they don't. I mean, we just shouldn't. The political rhetoric is just that. Watch what I do. The jobs bill, the so-called jobs bill that passed a couple weeks ago, was a deregulation bill,
mm-hmm.
and it was shameful. So, you know, I think what people are, the good news is people aren't sort of waiting around for President Obama to lead. That's very nice that he wants to echo public opinion, which is overwhelmingly way beyond what he and members of Congress are debating. And that pressure is just going to keep building. I mean, I actually think there's the corporate elite obviously doesn't hold all the cards. We should be pressing for reforms. I would call them what Andre Gorz calls revolutionary reforms,
mm-hmm.
Reducing the nexus of money and influence on elections. We need to have this proposal to break up the big banks well articulated so that the next time the banks screw up, which could happen any day,
mm-hmm.
and we're asked to bail them out, that we say, no, these banks are they're not only too big to fail, they're too big to save. And we need to protect our communities from these banks. And so we put forward the more radical proposal to break up those banks.
The question of the politicians there, and the government is sometimes it's referred to as a representative government. Clearly, it's an unrepresentative government. I've been alive a long time and read a lot of history. In my lifetime, it's never been so unrepresentative as it is now. One of the problems that's different, one of the things that's different now than it was in the 30s or any other time, is the corporate control of the media. I mean, I have another show on Sirius XM on satellite radio. And I get calls from all over the country, and people tell me that there is no more local radio. You know what I mean? It's all, wherever they go, wherever town they live in, it's controlled by three or four corporations, all of which are basically right-wing and censorship.
Yeah.
So that didn't happen before in the 30s. So, in other words, thank God for the Internet, right?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I think that if we were sitting here in 1912, 100 years ago, we would probably be having a very similar conversation.
Mm.
But there was a rich radical newspaper tradition and radical forums. People got together in person and heard from speakers of the day. And, of course, the postmaster cracked down and banned a lot of those newspapers and repressed this kind of flowering independent media. Interestingly, here we are. I think that it's both bleak and there are these sort of interesting seeds. People are getting information. They're using, you know, sort of the new media platforms. There's a way in which people are bypassing Clear Channel.
Oh, yeah.
They still have a huge lock on our airwaves. But there's some room to move, and I think information is like your show and others are getting out to people. So maybe it's dark just before dawn.
Well, that's a good way. That's a very good way to look at it. I mean, so but in your book, by the way, you're listening to Chuck Collins, and he is a scholar with senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a great place to check out, by the way, on the web, Institute for Policy Studies. And he's got the new book out, 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Let me ask you about, I get a lot of people on my show sometimes. I've interviewed Dr. Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson, who are running third-party candidacies, right? I mean, people are so disgusted with these two parties, as well they should be. Any normal person would be, any decent citizen. When you're not rejecting, I mean, a lot of people are just completely rejecting the whole idea of voting, right? But some people are saying, okay, then what about a third party? I mean, what's your position on that?
Well, I think of voting as 1/3,000th of my civic involvement and responsibility, you know. So, yeah, I should go out and make a strategic choice on the election day which candidates will do less harm. You know, that's just, I renounce voting. In fact, I think people should be engaged. And there's lots of state and local races that are going to have a huge impact on the future. And as well as, you know, again, don't think of it as a major expenditure of your psychic or, you know, time. Just do it. Make a strategic choice. That's my view. Mm-hmm. I think that the role of third parties is to bring forward ideas, challenge the dominant parties. I think, unfortunately, because of the way our political system works, they tend to be spoilers when in the, you know, drawing votes away from the lesser two evil candidates, sometimes getting more evil.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's the risk you take because you want to create independent platforms. It's better when, like in New York State, where you can fuse parties, you can have a candidate run on multiple tickets and you can vote on the Working Family Party in New York and that can send the message. But I would argue people need to, you know, I think it's important to build third parties, make the case, have candidates who are in debates lifting up the issues that are left out by the two major parties, and then on election day, using 1/3,000th of our civic responsibility time, make a strategic choice whether the third party is going to be a spoiler and make things worse, or whether you hold your nose and vote for the lesser two evils. That's the national political picture.
Now, you know, you notice that the just like a zombie that arises from some dark swamp where you thought it vanished for a while, the budget committee is back, you know, the super committee, whatever it is, and the Republicans have proposed the budget where, of course, they want to, you know, save weapons and basically kill off poor people. Sorry, my opinion. But, you know, when we're faced with something like this and when there is no chance whatsoever that we can influence the Congress like this. What about boycotts? You notice what happened with Rush Limbaugh, right? It was interesting to me that it's interesting that capitalism can work two ways. It's a two-edged sword, right? I mean, he is imposed on local stations all over the place by corporate media. Sometimes he's not even rated that high, but he's imposed anyhow. And people decided they were sick and tired of his vile behavior and his hurtful behavior and his lies. And they didn't, and a lot of people say this is censorship trying to get him off the air. But what people did is exercise their rights like they did with South Africa once upon a time, not to buy his sponsor's products. And that's what hurt him, right? So that's a kind of action too, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess I would say each of us have way more tools in our political tool bag than we sometimes think about, you know. You know, voting is 1/3,000th of our activity, but we are consumers. We can use our consumer power. Some of us are investors or are part of organizations that might have investments, like my religious congregation or my city has investments in some of the big banks. You know, so I can press to have funds removed from those banks, move my money. Mm-hmm. The whole move my money movement is very important. I think that I would argue, though, that one of the things we're so weak on from a social change infrastructure is we don't really have we act too much as individuals, and we need to form something, you could call it an affinity group or a circle. We have there's this movement of resilience circles around the country, people getting together sort of saying, hey, we're making a transition to a new economy, how do we support one another, how do we learn together and take action together. So I've encouraged people to think about, how do you form an affinity group, get, you know, 5 to 15 of your friends together, you know, break bread, have a meal together, and talk about how can we together, not just as individuals sitting in front of computers, but how can we together take action. And not everybody's in a position where they can, you know, join nonviolent direct action.
Right.
But might be part of a group where you can support someone else, you know, to do that.
So in other words, we really do have to go beyond clicking a mouse or texting somebody.
That's actually my point. It's actually the social media stuff is great for, like, a boycott. You're putting pressure on an advertiser, and you get 3,000 people to call up an advertiser and say, I'm not buying your product because you're supporting Rush Limbaugh's show. That's hugely powerful, and we should all be doing those kind of things. But we sort of need to revive our face-to-face cell structure, our affinity group structure.
Mm-hmm.
And people should check out, there's a little website called localcircles.org, which talks about, you know, forming a local circle. But it's, you know, it's nothing. It's just not doing it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And finding, even if it's five friends, and saying, okay, next Monday together, we're all going to go to be part of that protest together. We're going to take actions together. And learn from it, and don't get cynical, and support one another in real ways to take meaningful action.
I guess it really doesn't mean anything anymore that now we're very aware of the fact, and it's getting worse all the time, that the NSA is listening to probably what, you know, they're recording this conversation. They've got your Google searches. They got your cell phone. I mean, you just take it for granted that you do the right thing anyhow because it's still your country and you want to reclaim it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's not the Hunger Games yet, you know.
Not quite yet.
There's a little room to move here, you know.
let me ask you this question. One of the things, I think you mentioned in this, your book, and it's connected to this. For instance, like one thing in your book that you talk about is the credit card debt that's gone up. I'm not sure, you know, student loans, everything, but credit card debt. Now, I noticed also that when I was reading this article, it said that you know, the credit card companies were forbidden to, or they were told to damp down their solicitations to people. But this brings into question another whole aspect that I wanted you to comment on, is that you can't just blame everything on the rich, right? I mean, this is a country that constantly consumes more than it can pay for, or more than it even needs. So aren't we all somewhat to blame in a way?
Well, I think that's a very important thing that, you know, I think that one of the things I like about the 99-to-1 framework is it does focus, you know, attention on the 1% and their role. But in fact, you know, many of us in the 99%, well, first of all, globally, we are the 5%, you know, and our level of consumption and destruction of the Earth's resources and carrying capacity is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do need to hold up, look into the mirror sometimes and say, how do we cooperate with the system? How do we enable it as consumers or with the lifestyles that we lead or with the ways in which we act, you know? So I think that focusing on the 1% is important, and I also think sort of saying, okay, how in the great tradition of John Woolman, you know, how do I contribute? And how can I make choices that de-link me from this system that's exploiting other people and globally just completely unsustainable. So I think that's a really important point, and to be humbled by the fact that, yes, globally we are the 5%, and we're not all bad. You know, mm-hmm. neither is, you know, within the 1%, there's a huge number of allies. There's a whole group of patriotic millionaires, hundreds of millionaires, who are out on Tuesday, on tax day, saying, for the love of God, raise our taxes. Raise taxes on me,
mm-hmm.
so that other people can get college educations if that's what they want. So I think that it doesn't all lock down or break down 99-to-1, even though that's the title of my book.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't you mention something in your book about having grown up in the 1%, quote unquote?
Yeah, no, I actually grew up. My family was from a meatpacking family. I grew up in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, and went to high school with Mitt Romney. So Mitt and I are like, we are in the 1%. I grew up in the 1%, so did he, and we went to the same high school. And
Not at the same time. Or
he's a little older than me.
Right.
But he was a senior, and when I was a seventh grader.
Huh.
But, you know, part of my point there is there are, you know, I come from the 1%, and I have organized other people in the 1% through patriotic millionaires and wealth for the common good to speak out for an economy that works for everybody. And there's allies there to be tapped into.
Mm-hmm. So, in the end, you do have the last part of your book, which is very helpful and encouraging, is to just laying out what people can do. But this spring and this summer are going to be, to me, they seem like pivotal historical moments. You know, like every decade or every generation, you get a pivotal historical moment, maybe. This has to be one. You've got the two political conventions, and you've got the Occupy movement coming swinging back into full bore all over again. And yet they're going to be met with a far more focused, more over-militarized police force than they've ever encountered before, right? So it's going to be quite a summer, right?
I think we're in for, I agree, Mike, we're in for interesting times, and I think the Occupy movement has catalyzed and even humbled some of the traditional social movement organizations, and I think, though, that the good outcome is that things are going to, even more people are going to get involved. You know, I was just with leaders of the National Nurses Union.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands and thousands of nurses are now mobilizing around a Wall Street financial transaction tax. The 99th, you know, the tax day, there were hundreds of actions. May Day, this Tuesday, a day of action against Wells Fargo Bank. So there's just going to be rolling ways in which people to get involved at all levels. You don't have to sleep out in a tent. You can support all kinds of other efforts that I think are going to be critical to changing things. And here's the, you know, think about where we were 2 years ago. We were in, after this huge economic meltdown, tax day, and all you heard about was the Tea Party.
Right.
You know, last year, tax day was up for grabs. It was more, you know, how corporate tax dodgers are, you know, the U.S. Uncut movement was bringing to our attention corporate tax dodging. This year, it's all about how millionaires are dodging taxes. And that's a good example of how the social movements have changed the conversation.
Well,
I
think they really have, because even the Republicans don't make a big deal about it anymore. They finally laid off saying that if more of us were rich, the money would trickle down. Even they have given up, at least for public relations purposes, on that. You know, I think
even Citigroup's shareholders.
I know. Yeah,
voted down their CEO's, you know, grotesque pay package. Well, that's, you know, that's about time.
Yeah,
but it's part of this larger change.
Well, then you've got to watch out, because, you know, millionaires seem to come in all different forms and generations. Google the other day decided to split its stock, and people were saying, "Oh, that's great! Look what they're doing for us." And they pointed out in the financial section of the Times they weren't doing it for you at all; they're doing it for themselves because they can retain bigger, better control over, you know, what they do. But I noticed that the Citigroup shareholders, and that's something you recommend in your book, is that shareholders have to take control of the corporations, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's just, and again, you may not individually own a share stock, but you probably are part of an organization that may own a share stock, whether it's an education institution or a city or a religious congregation.
Pension fund. Mm-hmm.
Pension funds. You have investments. We don't use that power, that untapped power, enough. And even though a shareholder resolution sometimes doesn't pass, you know, the vast amount of share, it's a huge educational opportunity. Showing up at shareholder meetings, as we're going to do at Tuesday with Wells Fargo, is going to have a huge impact. They are feeling the pressure.
Where can people go? This is Chuck Collins you're listening to, and the book is 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. So now, what's a good website for centralized information that people can go to, and they can, you know, then spread out from there?
You know, one portal I recommend is inequality.org, and there you can find information about Sam Pizzagatti's newsletter called Too Much.
Mm-hmm.
You can see information about our book. And then if you link to the organizations that are listed there, you'll see the 99% Spring and some of the mobilization efforts that are happening around the country. So that's one portal that's easy to remember, inequality.org.
Okay. I think the last hopeful thing that I wanted to say, you know, and we're talking on the radio right now, and maybe it's because I've been in broadcasting for so long. The one of the most hopeful things I've seen in a long time is the FCC finally granting license applications for low-power FM stations to nonprofit organizations all over the country. That's a really great thing.
Yes, yeah. And that's something that we obviously should jump on and build upon.
Right.
That there's a weak link. You know, there a few communities have great community radio stations, you know, Portland, Oregon, and Madison, Wisconsin.
Right.
But they're just not filling the void. left, you know, so community organizations should think together. How can we build, how can we become the media and not just complain about it?
Right. So, I mean, it's easy enough, too. I mean, you just go straight to the FCC and it's an application process. Well, so thank you very much for the book and for coming on here. And I think things are hopeful here. I mean, this is a time of tremendous turmoil and torment for some people. And I think things finally might just get flipped over. So I hope so.
Yeah, I think you're right, Mike. And I'm just glad you have this forum and this conversation. I think it's part of how we're going to all learn together and move forward.
Okay. Chuck Collins, the book's 99-1. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Once again, I advise you all to try to check out our Facebook page, Occupied Territory Facebook page. Just Google Occupied Territory on Facebook. I really want to get your comments, any videos you want to post, any reactions to the show. The podcasts are available from there. And we're going to take a break now and come back in just a little bit. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. I'll keep you updated on how the rich are doing so we know who to go after and what to do. Here's a new one. Psychologists have developed a lucrative new niche. They're training the therapists banks hire to counsel their clients with fortunes worth $25 million and up. Now, I know a lot of you have been in therapy and a lot of you feel depressed or anxious, and some people feel like they may qualify as neurotics or even totally out of their minds. I know I do and have done many times. But if you have enough money, this is what you can get now. If you have $25 million and up, you can get there's a resident psychologist available to you at your local bank. Occupy and other protests against inequality have some of those of these wealthy so spooked that therapists like John Warnick, a consultant with U.S. Bank, don't use the word wealthy anymore with clients. They're opting for legacy families. Wealthy is a bad word. So that's good. If you change the language, you can change everything. What is it, you know, the old principle is somebody, give somebody the right kind of lever or the right kind of fulcrum, and you can just shift the whole world, right? Well, language is a big thing. Somehow, the right wing and right wing talk radio and everybody else turned liberal into a nasty or dirty word. I don't feel that way. I think you can reclaim language, too. You can regenerate words that have been allegedly shot full of arrows and died. I like the word liberal. I'm proud to be a liberal, right? If not actually a radical. Being a liberal now is something even the left doesn't like it anymore, so maybe it's tired that way. And I never liked the word progressive. That's the word everybody uses now. Even it's called the Progressive Radio Network here. To me, I don't know, that's kind of a pale word. Liberal was a fine word until the right destroyed it. But, you know, we can reclaim words back. But now the wealthy are afraid to use the word wealthy. I think that's a great thing. Also, I think what we should do is make the new dirty word capitalist. There's nothing wrong with that. And I'm not talking about some knee-jerk left-wing communist, you know, linguistic attack. Why not? It is the capitalists who own and run the government, who have destroyed most of our lives, time out of mind, from the beginning up until now, all over the place. They destroyed whole countries. Sometimes countries turn on them, and capitalist becomes a dirty word. In Iceland, for instance, in 2009, 2010, they were totally in debt because their banks and other banks that had control over their economy, including U.S. banks, had destroyed their economy the same way they destroyed our economy and every other economy. And Iceland refused to pay their creditors. They wouldn't pay foreign banks. They wouldn't pay sovereign governments back on sovereign wealth funds. They just said, no, you can't have the money. We need it for our people. And they just refused to pay it. Now, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? They just refused to pay it. So they understood that capitalism was a bad thing. Not to make it too simplistic, it's a bad thing. It's not a good thing the way everybody assumes it is. I mean, part of the thing in the United States has been, and this is one of the problems that everybody in this country is infected with, just being born here and growing up here, is one of the reasons why people have gotten away with so much crap and so much evil, people who were rich in this country, is because what's held out to you, and it seems to have been the case in many, you know, before in other generations, and sometimes still is, and you see it with the dot-com people, right, who get rich overnight or work in their garages or develop an app like Instagram or something like that and get rich overnight. You have $1 billion within 2 years. So it's still happening. The basic understanding in America that you're brought up with here is, you know, Obama's always going on in his mealy-mouthed, disgusting way about the American dream. You know, a right to a house and a decent job and school for your kids. No, the American dream is to get rich. We all know that, right? Left, right, middle. What we understand growing up as Americans is we all have the right and the ability to get rich. And if we work really hard or if we find an angle or if we push or even if we, you know, cut corners, whatever we have to do, we can get rich. And that's what the American dream has always been. It's more of an American nightmare. It's not. This is what winds us up every once in a while in the mess we're in right now. Because it's not just because rich people come in and just grab everything at the point of a gun, although it's almost coming to that sometimes. It's because everybody believes that rich people should be allowed to get away with all this because one day we could be one of them. We can get rich too. And we can buy a giant house that we don't need even one-tenth the space of. And we can buy four more houses. And we can buy and buy and buy and buy things we don't need that use up energy, that use up resources that other people need just to survive. We can just eat it all up like giant cannibal monsters, right? Because we have the right to do that. The whole principle of America has been based on expansionism, on taking over other countries, of stealing what other countries have, literally and figuratively, of robbing people. And then when the whole world gets raped and looted, they often just turn on themselves. And we, people in this country, the rich corporations, rape and loot us. But the reason, one of the reasons they get away with it, and I'll reiterate this again, one of the reasons I think that people get away with this kind of stuff in this country and why people are howling in agony over it is because we all secretly believe that we could be one of them or we could have been one of them. A lot of us know now that we're not going to be. You know, obviously not everybody gets to be like baseball players, football players, people on professional sports teams make $10 million, $20 million a year, whatever it is. Every kid who was growing up when I was in the 50s, every kid who was growing up and wanted to play baseball, right? Baseball was everything and maybe some football. Everybody was going to be a baseball star in the 50s, right? And the idea was, though, it was a little bit different, though. There wasn't so much money grubbing involved, but still it was there. You grow up, you get to be famous. You get to be famous and you get to have a lot of money. You get to have a big car and a big house. I mean, whatever our lower middle class Queens, New York dream was of being rich. That was to have a Cadillac and maybe to have an Oldsmobile or a Buick, and you had a really big house and you maybe had a really big lawn. Everybody, depends on your class and how you grew up, what you think rich is, right? I mean, when Romney was growing up, he was already rich. You know, you have to think, what does he wonder rich was? Well, I guess it is what he has now, $250 million, where he's building a new house. He's building an addition to his house out in California, one of his four houses that he doesn't really need. He's going to put a car elevator in there, right? Now, a lot of people, they're not honest. People, a lot of times people are not honest. A lot of us do understand, despite our good intentions, and we do want, I think people who listen to this radio station, people who are sort of within the ambit, within the sort of the large circle of radio stations and websites and newspapers that we all read and that we all understand, we do mean the right thing, and sometimes we do actually do the right thing. But one thing everybody has secretly in their heads is that basically that they can get rich, and they too can have all these things. So you see, just pick up the newspaper every month or every 3 weeks. There's somebody who's 29 or 28 or 36 years old who just got bought out by some giant company for $500 million because of something they came up with 2 or 3 years ago, some idea that they worked on. And so it just keeps perpetuating this idea that, you know, like if you hit the ball well enough, if you're smart enough and you could come up with it, a certain kind of software. But in its, now that's fine. That's fine, right? But to reward people with so much and such obscene amounts of money, there's just so much money to go around. If they have almost all of it, most of us have almost none of it, right? That's what the whole idea of 99 to 1 is. If we could somehow shift our understanding in this country or teach in a different way, but is it possible as Americans? This whole country was based on stealing. We stole this country to begin with. We built it on the backs of dead Native Americans and slaves. We just basically stole this country. And this country has been a force for good sometimes in its history, but it's been a force for evil too. And part of that is this sense of we can have whatever we want if we just work hard or have a lucky break or work the angles or somehow shift things our way, or if we come up with a brilliant idea, right, that we can get rich. That is the entirely wrong way to look at things, and yet it's part of our bone marrow in the United States. It's why I think that a lot of people sit by sometimes or allow people to become so rich and to have so much power over the rest of us, because we secretly believe that, or I should say maybe we used to, thank God it's fading, we used to believe that we could be one of these people too, that we could get rich too. So, you know, this is something I think that people need to really address. It's like becoming aware of your own dark side, to use a certain phrase. Something to announce here. Let's see. Is this going to be at the Foundry Theater? Cooper Union? Oh, okay. So at Cooper Union, if you're in the New York City area or you want to travel down or up or over to the New York City area, this Friday through Sunday, that's the April 20th through April 22nd, at Cooper Union in New York, there's going to be would you want to come on and announce this? No? Okay. There's going to be an assembly here, and it's a meeting about I guess how a festival of dialogues, it's called, about another world under construction. And it's something called the foundrytheater.org. You want to get more information about this, which is better than listening to me be inarticulate, because there's a lot of information here to read. But it's called the foundrytheater.org, and it's at Cooper Union, which is a famous place for meetings of such things, Friday, April 20th through Sunday, April 22nd. And check it out. Cooper Union is in Manhattan, on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, or actually sort of the East Village part of Manhattan. And Amy Goodman will be one of the moderators. She's the host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, as most of you know. And there will be dialogues, there will be meetings, there will be speeches, there will be workshops, presenters about the economy, about another kind of media, about another kind of politics. And I'm looking through some of the names, which I don't recognize, but that doesn't mean anything. So this is okay. People from everywhere, from all over the world, activists everywhere. So this is part of what's happening here, is that the inevitable is happening with the Occupy movement. This is called Occupied Territory, after all this show. The inevitable is happening, that all these disparate groups that have been all over the place and have been horizontal with no up-and-down structure, with no authoritarian structure, which is just fine considering what those structures did for us all these years, all these generations. However, it is finally taking an inevitable turn, which is that all these things are beginning to coalesce into one larger group. So the same way that a human being becomes a human being, starts out with, you know, cells, and then they divide, and then they randomly join and divide again, and they build up and up and up until it's one coordinated, till you get old and break down, it's one coordinated human being that is able to walk and think and perform tasks and dream and do all kinds of other things. But it's the same way with everything in nature, and it's the same way with political structures and with activist structures. When you have something like this meeting, and I guess, is it thefoundrytheater.org? Would that be a good place to go to check it all? Okay, the Foundry, F-O-U-N-D-R-Y, thefoundrytheater.org will tell you all about this meeting, and I'm sure there will be
Live streams worldwide? Okay. So everything is, centered from that website. So go there and check that out. So I think the idea here is that we have to understand that yes, it is pretty bad. The government is useless. It works for rich people. Rich people have their hands on our throats. Now, presuming that they don't literally declare martial law and that the militarized police and the army, which President Obama has decided can actually come back and go after terrorists in the United States, presuming that it doesn't become a complete military police state, a complete fascist dictatorship, which is teetering on the brink of. We still have media like this, like PRN and other outlet, the radio outlets. We have all sorts of websites. We have ourselves. We have our social media. But we got to watch out for that. Now, obviously, places like Facebook and clearly Google are just ancillary, parts of the fascist state at this point. Now, I hate to keep throwing in that phrase because it sounds so hackneyed, but that's what's happening. Google has made it very clear, and they're rolling over like a poodle. They don't mind at all. Google is part of the United States government now. And if you're wondering about whether or not that's true or not, just Google, go to Google and use their own tools. Google NSA and Google and see how many hits you come up with. Probably, unless they've removed it, 102,000 of them. Google is a partner with the United States, with the NSA and the United States government. They are helping track every search you make, everything you buy, everything. And if you have Gmail, you know, just like any other email, but especially Gmail, anything you send to anybody on Google, anything you text, any application, anything you use, Google owns YouTube. Google owns everything, right? Everything that you do with Google is automatically recorded or can automatically be recorded and used as information by the United States government. Not conspiracy theory, just the truth. So, you know, this is what you have to be aware of. We can use all the social media. We can use the networking. We can go to the websites. But you have to do it with this understanding, the same way we all did it back in the day, right? When you go out and you put yourself in people's faces, if you're going to block doorways or sit in the lobbies of banks, if you're going to crash meetings, you know, of the rich, if you're going to go to shareholder meetings, if you're going to surround government buildings, if you're going to do things like that, you're going to pay for it. There will be cops there. The army will be there. They will put you on lists. This is not going to happen for free. Bodies will get hurt. Lives will get impinged upon. They'll sic the IRS on you. They will investigate you. They will do things that you don't even know they're doing it because they have that capability. This is the way it goes. It happened every time in this country that there were large outcries of social protest because the rich were pushing everybody around to the point of where it was unbearable, to the point almost of revolution. Every time this happens, people poured out in the streets or people expressed their outrage or had meetings. A lot of people got beat up. A lot of people got locked up. People got hurt. People's lives were ruined sometimes. It's inevitable. This is what happens. It happens anywhere, anytime in your own life. If you want to make progress, sometimes you have to do it through blood and you have to do it through mud. That's how it goes. It's slow, hard going sometimes. Nothing is ever achieved without some pain. Nothing worthwhile or radically different in your own life, in a relationship, anywhere. Nothing like this can ever be changed without paying the dues for it. And the dues these days is, if you're going to go out there and physically sit in at the Bank of America or at Wells Fargo, or if you're going to intrude on these conventions or demonstrate at conventions, if you're going to do May Day protests, if you're going to do any of these things, or you're going to go to Occupy sites, you are going to pay for it. And people have to accept that that's going to happen. Yes, there should be outrage when the police lose their minds and do things like they did last fall and part of the winter. And there should be outrage when kids at school are pepper sprayed by people. Why that man is not in jail? Has he yet not been indicted? I forget his name. Lieutenant John Pike, I think his name was, who sprayed those kids out at UC Davis. I mean, if he hasn't been indicted and if he doesn't get sentenced to something like 10 years in jail for that assault on those kids, I don't know, you know, what to think. But he probably won't be. He'll probably just be dismissed from the police force and get a job as a security guard somewhere and thump somebody else one day. But that's how it goes. And what we're going to have to pay these days, A, is if we get out there and physically act act out, literally, if we act up and act out, we're going to pay for that. And it's usually younger people who do that, and they usually are the ones who pay for it, just like we paid in the 60s, people paid in the 30s, the people paid when they were forming unions around the turn of the century in 1900. That's what happens. You pay for it. The Civil War, look what happened. Almost 700,000 Americans got killed. If you multiply that by inflation and number of people in the population, it's like 7 million Americans died in that war. And one of the reasons they fought that war, and one of the purposes was, and one of the goals was, and one of the achievements was to free people from slavery. Well, we're under a kind of slavery. If we want to do something about it, this is what we're going to pay. Every time I do a show like this, every time that you press a button to listen to the podcast, every time you text somebody or go to a website or make a search or use anything in an email, one of 1,000 words that they don't like, they think is wrong, they're going to put you on a list. You're already probably on a list. And we're all going to have to understand that we're going to pay for these things. So much for my speech there. How much time do we have left before we go out? 3 minutes? Okay. Here, just to keep you abreast of more doings of the idiotic rich, let's see. George W. Bush resurfaced in New York last week for a speech on public policy. He can make a speech. What has George W. upset enough to rejoin the public debate? He's worrying that Congress will let his tax cuts for deep pockets expire at the end of this year. Listen to this. This is a quote from George W. Bush. If you raise taxes on the so-called rich, Bush told his audience, you're really raising taxes on the job creators. First of all, this cretin, this moron, this low-life scum that used to be the president of the United States, he doesn't know what he's talking about when he says this. He's actually being, did you ever see old puppets or old marionettes? He is actually being operated. Probably Dick Cheney has his arm and his whole fist up to his shoulder, up George Bush's ass, and his fingers are operating his arms and legs and his face when he speaks. So he says, so-called rich. The so-called rich? Call it like it is. Rich is rich. This is a guy who grew up from the second he was born. He had everything he wanted. He probably doesn't even know what money looks like, right? And he's repeating the same old tired crap that the rich are job creators. This is his whole Ayn Rand nonsense, that if you give, you know, the people who have a lot of dynamic power and a lot of energy and a lot of will, if you give them a lot of money, and if they have a lot of money, then they will spread it around to the rest of us. Bull. It's never going to happen, never has happened, and it never will happen. And so there's two things involved here, the essential points I wanted to make. The rich will never give us anything. We have to take away what they have and spread it around to the rest of us. I mean, take it away. And the second thing is, we should not aspire to have billions of dollars. We shouldn't all think that we're going to be rich. I mean, some of us we're not going to be because we've already blown our chances, right? But that is not a way to teach your kids or how to get your kids to grow up in this country, that they can be rich. That is what one of the things that's created the evil that has become American society. Anyhow, this is Mike Fader, and this is Occupied Territory. We're here every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please get involved with the show if you want, and do it by going to the Facebook page. And it's Occupied Territory and Facebook. Just put that into your search engine, Occupied Facebook, Occupied Territory and Facebook, and you will go there, and you can comment on this show, and you can comment on anything, put on videos. I'll have things up there. And that's what we need you to do. Okay, so I will see you. Actually, I have – oh, there's one thing I wanted you to do. Check out the video I did on YouTube, speaking of Ayn Rand. I did a video on YouTube. And just go to YouTube or Google YouTube and New Republican Prayer, New Republican Prayer. Okay, that's it for this week. I'll be back Monday to do my other show, The Turning Point, at 4 p.m., and then I'll be back next week on Thursday, and we're going to have a really interesting guest next Thursday. Thank you.